Welcome to the Mojo Podcast, and something of a new angle, perhaps for this podcast today. This week, we're looking at the subject of global harmony. Yes, as ever, it's all about the big subjects on the Mojo Podcast. I suppose much of what I speak to guests about, usually each week, is very personal and individual mojo, their story, their action. This week, I wanted to look at our collective mojo a little more. So why now, you ask? Well, this is a somewhat rare episode, as I've also timed it to coincide with an event that I believe will have an impact of varying degrees on all of us over time, and that is the 59th US presidential election. So by the time you hear this episode, the election will be done. We hope a clear result will emerge, and from that, of course, certain actions will follow. And a particular angle that I want to explore today around this idea of global harmony is the relationship between East and West. For so long, one of the major geopolitical fault lines globally. Now, to ensure the episode is timely, we're recording this in the last couple of days of campaigning. We don't know the result, and we're also not looking to sway any voters in the US, by the way. The Mojo Podcast is, let's say, apolitical. I care about politics, as do many of my guests, but we're not going to be forcing any views on you today. We're simply examining the possibilities and seeing the effect on Mojo that greater understanding of other worldviews, other cultures can have. So we remain true to two of the core values of the Mojo Podcast, and that's to be inspiring and to be positive. To undertake a conversation about global harmony, cultural alignment, East-West relations, I need a very special guest, and I have just the person. Ali Barani. Ali is the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors, a boutique firm based in the UK, London in the UK, that specialises in emerging markets focused on geo-economic and geo-strategic developments around this decoupling of East and West.
Ali is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts,
a geostrategy expert with the Family Enterprise Foundation, and a mentor to budding entrepreneurs through Mowgli Mentoring. Ali excels in providing unconventional design thinking on growth and strategy, and acts as a sparring partner to senior executives, family businesses, and next generation leaders. At heart, Ali is a storyteller, podcaster, a broadcaster, an iconoclastic critic of current affairs, and a keen observer of this decoupling of East and West that I mentioned. He is the co-founder and host of the Round Peg Podcasts, in which he curates some of the most interesting conversations with global business leaders, family businesses, diplomats, and other key decision makers, and recently launched his own YouTube channel called 120, which I thoroughly recommend, and the links to that and his podcast will be in the show notes. Now, Ali and I were introduced by another previous guest of the Mojo Podcast, the wonderful Richard Bellers, back in season one, episode 15. We've had some fabulous conversations since then. I love his very creative way of seeing and interweaving the world. He's opened my eyes for sure. So I was very keen to get him on the podcast for a while, actually. And this week, today indeed, just seemed the most appropriate time. So with no further ado, Ali, welcome to the Mojo Podcast.
Well, Richard, it's a pleasure, and I'm delighted to be with you, albeit the fact I'm in a cloudy, rainy London, and you're in Ibiza in the, under the sun. Nice to be with you.
Well, it's lovely to hear your voice, and yes, we're in different locations, but very much connected. I'm very much looking forward to this conversation. So, Ali, as I always start my conversations with guests, how's your mojo today out of 10 in that rainy London you describe?
I think I've been listening to your wonderful podcast. I have two mojos. I have a personal mojo and a universal mojo. And my personal mojo is 9 out of 10. And my universal mojo is 3.5 out of 10.
Oh, wow. Okay. Two mojos. Well, tell me about those.
Well, my personal mojo is more what I would abbreviate it into as like a meaningful odyssey of joy and optimism. That's life, right? It's an odyssey. Mm. Each of us have our own odyssey. So that is 9 out of 10. But my universal mojo is what I miss as a monumental officiation of justice and opportunity, which is lagging in the world today. So that's why it's 3.5 out of 10. Yeah, yes. When I look at the state of the world at the moment, it's it's very perplexing, to put it mildly, because not everybody has access to the same privileges that many of us enjoy. So there is a massive gap. There is a decoupling as well, not necessarily in shortening this gap, and it's not just between East and West, but even within societies in the West and within societies around the world. To share a graphic example of that, when India locked down for COVID-19, all these migrant workers, which were not in like 1,000, 2,000, millions of them, were asked to leave Delhi and, you know, Calcutta and, you know, and the rest. And some of them had to march and walk, Richard, for hundreds of kilometers without public transport. Many of them dehydrated and, you know, perished along the way. So when I talk about universal mojo and then I talk about opportunity and justice, I'm taking a tour de force around the world, domesticating it or personalizing it. So I hope that helps.
Got it. No, that's really clear, and thank you for that. I think that's a really interesting view. I think we probably all have that, but maybe when I ask that question to people, as I said right at the beginning, it's very much it is a personal view. It is my personal mojo. But I believe this sense of universal mojo is having an impact on all of us, whether we recognize it as being two separate forces, as you do. But I know it's there, which is partly why I really wanted to do this episode right now, actually. And you touch along, you know, a lot of the, I think, inequality is what I hear a lot of from what you're talking there around that justice and opportunity that's missing. As you say, it can be between East and West, but within countries as well. And you shining a light on, you know, one example there, what's going on in India, you know, I wasn't aware of that because the media that I consume at least hasn't picked up on that. Do you believe people that there's an awful lot that we're missing, that we're just not seeing?
No, I think many of us have become like the character Nemo, the cartoon. If you remember, one of them was always forgetting things. And our attention...
Dory, yes.
Yeah, so we become all little Dories in our spaces because there's so much of stimulation of headlines and such a fast-paced kind of foie gras feeding of the ducks with content that we have become somewhat, numb into pausing, reflecting, contemplating, and digesting. So we're just consuming, and many times many of these headlines are just another text at the bottom of the TV, and we don't pause and think that what does this mean and how this universal mojo will affect our individual mojos, you know. So I think it's a challenge, to put it mildly.
Yeah. And to that, again, your universal mojo and your individual mojo, when did you become aware of, you know, those two different elements for you? I guess I'm asking a little bit about your upbringing as well and what's brought you to where you are now. Is this something that's recent, or does this go way back to young Ali's life?
No, I sincerely believe one of the deficits in today's society around the world is the fabric of family. And I think if the upbringing is not nourishing and fulfilling and we can have all the vaccines in the world for pandemic, but if you're not vaccinated early on with, you know, love, spirituality, with a sense of collective, you know, to be the understanding that we're all intertwined, and, you know, this butterfly wing effect is not just for books. It's not just for East or, you know, mythologies. It's a reality. And this I would say, tidal wave of indifference will go around and come back. So I think a great part of that formation, the credit goes to family and to my parents. And I think we had an early exposure of being more attentive just by the sheer perhaps hard work of our parents of reminding us that, you know, other people are part of our life, not just an externality, I would say.
So that sense that, you know, your family unit, there was the focus of that importance of family, but within that, almost I get this sense of a sense of thoughtfulness, a sense of charity that maybe came out of, maybe were they core family values, I guess is what I'm asking about, when you were growing up, were these things very, very made very clear to you?
They were, and a great part of it was around empathy, self-confidence, contemplation, and spirituality, if I were, and all of it coated and wrapped in love, unconditional love. So I have had my share of a roller coaster ride, like everybody else. I've set up businesses, I've failed, I've had my moments of glory, I have been married, I have been divorced, you know, and I think this hero's journey is much more an exposure being on high seas of life, that if you don't have that sea light of family and the values, you can easily get lost and or drown. So in a metamorphical way of it, yes, I think that sea light has been the values and the learnings, and at the same time, you know, some hard luck from time to time from family, because I don't think it's all lovey-dovey, you know. So your best critics could be the ones who really love you, you know. There's this beautiful story about Rumi, and one of his disciples was, you know, struggling with the development, and goes to him and says, yeah, you know, why are you so tough on me? And then he takes him to the garden and says, you see that rug? And it was a Persian rug on a rope. And the guy was, you know, hitting the rug with something like a tennis racket to get the dust off and all that, you know. And he said, do you think he loves the rug, being tough with the rug? Or he doesn't like. So some hard love from time to time, I think, is essential.
So, Ali, tell me, how did this specific interest for you between East and West, and the relationship between, and the decoupling that you see, where did that come from? When did that emerge for you?
Well, I think we're all modern gypsies in more ways than one. And I'm a Persian by birth, a Canadian by choice and naturalization. And I have been, living and seeing things from a Middle Eastern, West Asia upbringing, but my formative years were, you know, in early age, obviously in Persia, in Iran, and then I have lived long enough, a great part of my life in Western Hemisphere, Canada, and now in London, in Dubai, and I always had this curiosity as to what is lost in translation. And that is not in English or, you know, in Persian or Arabic or anything like that, or Mandarin, but it's the optics towards what life means for each of these, which goes back into generations and the cultures. And we talk about clash of civilizations, but we don't talk about the dislocation of different cultures. And when we try to join these things just through economy and just through sheer force of market, we lose a great deal in between, at the expense of, you know, frictions, trade wars, conflicts. And we have to go a step back, in my humble opinion, and understand where we each come from, you know? How did we get here? and where we want to go together. And I think the narrative of where we come from, how did we get here, and where do we want to go, is always very dogmatic from both ends of the lens. So there is so much of work to be done in translation of not the language, I say again, but the cultures and the optics towards life, history, traditions and cultures, and how these have to fit and match in today's world.
Got it. So a lot of this sounds, you know, greater understanding and respect.
Respect is the right word, Richard. I think respect is absolutely the right word.
So this if we can somehow achieve that. So we set this up, you know, quite grandly at the beginning to talking around global harmony. But would you say, this is not a simple solution, clearly, but if we could have greater understanding and respect for one another, be that, as you said, it's East and West, but also within our own societies, that could somehow help.
A great deal. And I think one of the missing elements is safe spaces and safe zones for dialogue. These days, if you look at the talk shows, these days, if you look at the, you know, programs, everybody is coming in like a full contact martial arts to score a point. So that element of conversation and dialogue and benefit of doubt is parked at the door and in the parking. What comes in is that, you know, a lopsided, myopic from both sides in most cases, or an overriding, overarching access to podium and platform, which then puts the other party into a reactive position. So we hardly go to find conversation. It's a polarized dialogue, you know. I come to prove you wrong. You come to prove me wrong, you know. Yeah. We're not there to say, how can we have a convergence, and how can we leave, you know. And my view on a good conversation is in which you shake hands, and not now in these times of COVID, but when you leave, you can genuinely give a human hug to one another, you know. And I think that's missing. That is missing across the aisle, that is missing in various societies and globally evermore. So,
yeah, and that, you know, that's, it strikes me that politics, maybe it's modern day politics, is exactly that. It's not the art of a conversation in which you're going to express different views but somehow come to an agreement. It is, you're going to have your view, your dogmatic view often, and essentially maybe ignore what your opposite number, your competitor, has to say, because your mind is made up, it's fixed. Is it possible that, can politicians, can they be more collaborative? Can they be less competitive? Because that's, I think, what we see. Is there an opportunity for that, or is this wishful thinking?
No, I think that, you know, without hope, life would be very, very challenging, particularly in the era that we live in. I think it's not just about setting up new parties, you know. I think it requires work and long-term planning. Many years back, I was the head of corporate strategy and business development for Bosch and Siemens in Middle East. And I remember at one point, Robert Bosch had a shortage of engineers. And what they did was that they said, you know, our throughput is very low, so what are we going to do? So they hired anthropologists, psychologists, they interviewed the typical German, and they realized that the students are saying that, no, this is not a sexy job, we're not cool anymore, we don't want to be on a, you know, a factory or shop floor of a, you know, workshop to create gadgets or to do this and that. So what they did, Richard, interestingly enough, they allocated, I think at the time, around 65 million euros to distribute games and tool kits into nurseries and kindergartens to encourage the kids to be interested in engineering with anthropologists and psychologists, which is quite interesting when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
So I think developing a party is one thing. I mean, you know, En Marche in France, you know, here, you know, creating a party just needs political benefactors and an idea. Delivering that idea and developing a better harmonious society at home and abroad is something that I think requires work at an education grassroots level. You know, so to sit here and to this in this day and age to talk about BLM in the United States, to talk about massive disparities in some of the most democratically, you know, known societies in the world, I think it's not just about developing politicians, but it's about developing harmony that has to be ingrained in the DNA and psyche of that politician. Because if you can be swinged with donations and campaigns and special interest groups and all of that, it's, you know, different 50 shades of gray. It's nothing going to change. So I think that, yeah, it has to go grassroots. It has to go at the education level.
Yeah. Well, so on that, we're releasing this the day after the US election. Let's focus on that great country, that big country, that very powerful country, the US. And on that, because we look at the US now, it is perhaps the most polarized it has ever been, certainly in living memory. And exactly what you talked to there in terms of a more grassroots, a longer term investment as you take that lesson from private business, from what Bosch did. What do you think could bring, big question coming, what could bring the US closer together to heal some of the wounds and a lot of that? There's a lot of hatred, a lot of anger in that country right now. What could bring it closer together?
I think what's happening in the United States is very unfortunate and disorienting at home and abroad. And I think whenever we talk about a society being on Mojo programmed and to be, Mojo podcast, we have to remember that societies as well are a byproduct of what they are fed. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I want to make it clear that whenever we talk about US or any other country today or in future on your wonderful program, we should not blend the comments and the statements and apply them to people necessarily versus the system. Because to generalize and to have a broad stroke of statements around every American would be naive, would be unfair. But it would be very hard to look at the United States today and get inspiration from what's happening in the States. You hear that already they are talking about, you know, a post-election, God forbid, you know, violence, and you see that people coming out like Liberate Michigan with vans and all the full gear, you know, in rifles. And, you know, if the headline or if the landscape doesn't show it, one could say that this must be somewhere in Mogadishu as well, you know. I mean, I think that's one side of it. The other one is that the immigration and separation of the families at the border of Mexico. And, you know, there was a report and a headline. I don't exactly remember the numbers, but they were saying that around, you know, a massive number, above in hundreds of families don't know where their children are and they don't know where their parents are. Or if you look at the Black Lives Matter, and all of these things have really dented U.S. Brand equity. And the other thing is that I think U.S. is in an infliction point at the moment. And I say that because, for instance, we are one of the biggest challenges, which is subject of our conversation, is the decoupling of East and West, right? Mm. So President Trump is throwing baseball caps to the audience these days, thousands of them. And there are a lot of flags, decorating all of these rallies. All of them are made in China. these baseball caps that are written Make America Great Again are produced in China at 80, 85 cents, sold in United States for $12 or $15. I'm not kidding you, for each campaign, right? You know, so it's easy to throw a hat off to the public, but it's another thing to talk about greatness of America and say, where is this greatness? How it can be resurrected? Were we really great to begin with, or have we had the opportunity to overlook some of our, you know, handicaps along the way as well? And is it time to have a reset in America? So I was thinking maybe US needs, you know, to decouple on its own merits, to go back. You know, the society at the moment needs a detox in the state. And I don't think that the political elite on both sides, as Louis Black, the comedian, said, I don't know if I remember it correctly, he said, the Democrats blow and the Republicans suck. So I think they need a new thinking and they need a reset, So I don't have a magic wand to that, but I think a self-criticism is very important. And when we started, I was talking about hard love, right?
Yeah.
So if a society doesn't believe or doesn't have the willingness to accept its own handicaps, it is very hard to change course.
Yes, I get that. And that seems, that sense of self-criticism, reflection on your own actions, I know it doesn't seem terribly American to me. It seems quite unlikely. As we say, we come at this from we're trying not to talk in stereotypes, and we're thinking positively. But what would it take then? What would it take for America to go through that sort of that hand wringing of we've kind of got this wrong? Let's, as you say, let's detox. Let's restart. What could lead to that?
Well, listen, US has been a beneficiary of the world in more ways than one. And I don't mean just in access to resources, to energy, to minerals, etc. I'm not talking about that. I think US has been beneficiary of human capital of the world. And this human capital has been attracted to US, values or US spirit as a republic. Now, when you look at the language and culture, as I was saying, the term "he's a loser" is a very American term. So somebody has to lose, somebody has to win. Whereas in many cultures, it's about win-win.
Right.
In US, it's about individual. In Eastern philosophy, it's about collective. In long-term, planning and looking and history and culture, sometimes in some countries go back thousands of years, 2,000 years, 5,000 years. And over there, it's quarterly results. It's market that is driving a lot of things. And then all of this is now being very much in a massively tectonic swing in the United States, that you see the mixture of these underlinings with an increasing level of, mixture of, one would say, the state and church, and the role of religion that is coming in U.S. politics. So I think it's going to be very, very challenging for United States to accept in more ways than one that it needs help. And the first step for fixing something is to acknowledge you need help. And then to say, is this help domestically found or globally? And in this great power politics, I don't think the US will trust anybody. So it has to be homegrown. And homegrown, you need somebody who could heal the society. Unfortunately, I neither see in the Republicans nor the Democrats at the moment that finesse and that touch that could heal the U.S. society.
And that healing, as you say, that could come from a sense of, as you say, maybe borrowing from Eastern approaches, Eastern philosophy, that sense of the importance of the collective.
I think there is a great role. If you look at many of the things that have been developed in the United States, technology, automobiles, car industry, aviation, a lot of it were learnings from Europe as well. You know, a lot of them were immigrants. A lot of it was acquired by being the dominant power after the Second World War. So why not at this stage where you have everything in terms of intellectual advance, the size of microchips and, you know, nanotechnology, if you are short of some harmony and philosophy and, a different way of looking as to how to deal with this heartland or Eurasia, you know, at the end of the day, United States is 340, 350 million population, right? We live in a world of 7 billion people, right? A majority of them are interconnected by the virtue of the land in Eurasia and Heartland, right? So if you fail to understand how they think, how they tick, and try to convert them only to your model, this is a recipe for a misalignment. I want to always lately use this example of saying that the U.S. and the East, or Eurasia for that matter, are like an L4, L5 moment, like a lower back pain, you know? and you cannot break the back in order to fix it. It needs physiotherapy. It needs osteopaths. It needs people who can really lean in and provide an alignment.
Well, yeah, that's very timely, actually. My guest last time out was a posture coach, and we talked exactly about that part of the body, L4, L5, and the pain that comes from it. And what's coming, the metaphor that's coming up for me is this sort of the posture, perhaps, that, let's say, the US has taken has been one of power, one of maybe quite aggressive. It's not doing itself a lot of good standing that way. So if it needs to learn to stand differently, somehow, but as you said, who is going to be the person that moves the US's posture and enables it to stand in a different way?
Not only that, but before I answer your question, tissues in body have memories, you know?
Yes.
So when you have an injury, it may heal, but that tissue has a memory, has a genetic memory, you know? And I think for U.S. to find healing at home and abroad, it has to remember that a lot of tissues at home, including, racial relationships, its minorities at home, and in its adventurism outside, has left a lot of tissue memory that needs a lot of healing. And by applying sheer force on these layers, it can only, deepen the injury, you know? So yeah. That healing where you're talking about, I think, is acknowledgement, you know? As you know, I have a bald head and I don't have much of a hair. So I can stand in front of the mirror and every day praise my own hair. And to a point that I would start believing and combing my bald head and putting some gel as well, right? but acknowledging that I don't have hair is the first step, right? And accepting it. Mm-hmm. And I think U.S. Needs to acknowledge what it has missed, what it has done wrong at home and abroad. And that requires tremendous level of courage, audacity, and political selflessness that the current machine wouldn't, any political character like that without a strong social base will be shredded in the corridors of Democratic or Republican Party.
So I'm intrigued. You know, if we look, across the world, mm-hmm. do you see examples then of leaders in nations where they have somehow done this. They've brought a nation closer together. They have understood that sense of universal or collective mojo in their country, and they've had that sense of political selflessness, which you say is very rare. There may be none, but I'm just intrigued as to whether you've noticed anyone even getting close to that.
I think it is the one of those elements that, oh my God, I mean, when we talk about gender parity and equality, many of the things are always projected from and through the US lens. And let me come to your question from a different angle. One of the biggest deficits, even today in the United States, was and remains that in just 4 years ago, if you remember, United States was going up and down for the first female president in its history, right? And then this is projected to the rest of the world, whereas you had Indira Gandhi, late Benazir Bhutto, Golda Meir, in modern times, Jacinda Ardern, Angela Merkel. And surprisingly, Richard, female leaders have had that understanding for the collective. And I'm not, just for the record and clarity, as I said, I'm more of the, how do you say, in the camp of Louise Black on these two parties. So this is nothing to do with the last female candidate or anything like that. But in U.S. politics or Hillary Clinton, nothing like that. But I think if you wanted to do an audit today on leadership qualities, the Prime Minister of New Zealand and Angela Merkel really stand out. And if you look, and I can't stand the moment you talk to people, oh, but New Zealand is a small country. Oh, they're yeah. And then this is where I think we fail to say, oh, okay, let's see what is the governance model of Jacinda Ardern. Let's look at an East German prodigy that came from East Germany, Angela Merkel, and how has she held this engine of economy in Europe and remained so solid through her, period as a chancellor? So I think we need more female leaders because motherhood is something that at the moment, if Earth was, in my opinion, a family, there have been a lot of intoxicated, chauvinistic, gunslinging fathers in the neighborhood. So I think it's time for moms to come together and do some healing. That's my view.
Yeah, no, I love that analogy of the father with the perhaps the overbearing family, should say, overbearing father, but the mother who actually obviously full of feminine energy, but also highly organized, very rational, very clear about what needs to be done, but doing things in a way that brings people together, perhaps that empathy that you talked right at the beginning about.
If you go to biology, the mother cannot say, you know what, I'm going to deliver this one in 6.5 months. The next one I'll keep a bit longer for more than 9 months because I love him so much in my tummy, right? The nature will dictate. Or when she's breastfeeding, she doesn't come and say, oh, I'm going to give you only 1.5 liter through your, period of being breastfed, but the other one I gave 2 liters because I loved him more. Motherhood is, like a common denominator of love, you know. So I think the Earth at the moment needs a lot of that. And there, what's the race? Let's think about that as well, between East and West. The race is about content, about narrative, about the convergence, and about economy and consumers. What is missing in this race is which cultures have more to offer. And I'm not saying West has it all or East has it all. That philosophy of yin and yang is very important, you know? And we have lost sight of what are we racing for. And that plays itself in, you know, in this act of decoupling. My view is that West and East are at a very critical point in which that, you know, a great part of it is driven by economics and markets to an extent, Richard, that at the moment, because just to give you an example, China holds the highest level of deposits or proven deposits for rare earths, which are minerals that go into our iPhones, our cars, our, you know, gadgets.
Yeah.
The United States is thinking and proactively exploring, just listen to this one, digging at the bottom of the ocean, mining at the bottom of the ocean, and signing a protocol for mining on the moon through Artemis Accords. Mm. Now just think about the disruption we have caused to environment. All the blue planet that we watched with Sir David Attenborough and Planet Earth, as we haven't done enough harm that we want to go and dig at the bottom of the ocean and drill on the top of the moon without knowing the consequences.
Yeah, and this is the race that you talk to. Absolutely.
And my point,
the competition we're in.
Exactly. And my point is that, you know, we're all in this together. You know, when a tsunami hits on Pacific, you remember when Fukushima happened, it came all the way to India, right? So if there is a tsunami on western coast of United States or on Pacific side of China and Japan, we're in this together. So let us sit down, let us talk a little bit more about how we can collaborate, how we can coexist, and how we can co-develop and co-grow together.
Yes, and if COVID-19 has taught us anything, it's exactly what you just spoke to, right? This interconnectedness of the entire planet. We do not sit in isolation. We cannot sit in isolation. We have to find ways of working together
in more ways than one, without a doubt. But you know, the other thing is that we have lost, in my opinion, a sense of collective, as I said. And for that matter, one of my amazements is always that if you go to King's Cross or if you go to, Charing Cross or anywhere or on any European or in Atlanta, Georgia, pull the brakes and ask everybody to disembark from the tube or metro and ask them to just give the origins of whatever they're carrying on that day with them on the train, from their backpack to their Snickers to their jeans to their T-shirts. And phones and iPads, 65-70% of it is coming from China, right? So it is manufactured there. But whose product is it? Whose lifestyle is it? and who is driving this need for these products is the West, right? So to a great extent, the demand is generated by the West. The resources and manufacturing and competition resides in the East, right?
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that a great part of this dislocation in the West as well is about the distribution of income.
Yeah.
So in China, around 300 million people have been pulled out of what is defined as poverty in China in the past decade, okay? At the same time, when you look at the United States, unfortunately, 40 million people are on assisted nutritional assisted program, federal program, which is food stamps, right? Yeah. So for China, it's very hard to listen to the United States about equality and distribution of wealth and all of that. And then you would say, oh, but there are, you know, massive, rich, affluent people in China as well. There, that is true, but we forget as well that China came out of communism as such with closed markets only 50 years ago. And it's 1.4 billion people, Richard, right? So when some people go on their high horses in Western Hemisphere and Western capitals and say China is this, China is that, there may be a grain of salt and truth and fact to it. But one of the naivety as well is that China has to go through a velvet revolution. China has to democratize. China has to liberalize the people and all of that. And Richard, China is 1.4 million people. Let's say there is a red revolution or a green revolution or an orange revolution, the way some of these think tanks like in the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Let's say 5% of the Chinese, Richard, after that process, call it China glasnost, don't belong in China and want to sail to Europe or to America, where all these ideas and values are resonating. That is 70 million population, Richard.
Mm.
Europe is struggling with dealing with immigration.
Well, yeah. I mean, It brings that brings it very much to home, doesn't it? When I was just reading, you know, horrible numbers this week that 300 people have now died crossing from Calais to Dover in the English Channel. And this is since people started counting how many people were trying to cross over. So that puts it very firmly into a context, doesn't it, when you're talking about that number of people.
I mean, I'm not saying that China will go through that experience. I'm just saying it's very easy to sit in a think tank and talk about these things and then fast forward and, you know, and you have 70 million Chinese coming to your shores. I mean, it's what I'm trying to say, Richard, is that we trivialize geopolitics, culture, and complexities of the world many times through our own optics by saying this is not fitting our model, our narrative, so let's discredit it in its entirety. And what I'm trying to say is that for the world to go through a harmonious, coexistence, we have to first sandwich any criticism between two complements, because to say that there are no complements to be extended in both ways from Pacific to Atlantic and vice versa, it would be naive. But just to criticize and just to denounce is rather counterproductive. There is a Persian saying, I hope your listeners will forgive me. And that is like, somebody says, you haven't pissed on a hard wall, because it will eventually splash back at yourself. So I think it is very easy to criticize. It is much harder to find convergence and to heal. And that's a bigger art and a greater art, you know?
Absolutely agree with that. So Ali, I'm conscious that, you know, our time is slightly running short, and I just wanted to get, you know, a bit of a sense from you, because you have, you know, obviously all this running through your mind, these, as you say, these data points, there's history, there's all this knowledge that you've accumulated, and the consequences of certain decisions. As you say, it's easy to make criticism. It's harder to actually bring people together. How do you manage that for yourself? Let's go back to, you know, as you said, you know, you've got your personal and your universal mojo. Coming back to your personal, how are you managing that when all of this universal collective mojo is going on? Any things that you're doing?
Richard, you've raised a lot of great questions today, and this is another one. I guess doing is one thing, and having access to the right dose of wisdom is equally important. I benefit from having three wonderful mentors. Two of them are brothers. One is like a great turbocharge, a wind in my sail, and taking me to new shores and guiding me like a compass. The younger brother is like a harness, keeping me on board and on the boat. And whenever I need to moor an anchor and contemplate, the third one comes in. Also, I read views that I agree and I disagree with, because we lock ourselves in our echo chambers. Okay. And albeit the fact that sometimes when you disagree with something, your blood pressure may go up or you may dislike it, but it's healthy. It's necessary. Right. Otherwise, you develop atrophy in your thinking. Otherwise, you do not have the, I would say, the courage to face something you don't like. So that is dangerous. The second thing that has been rather very helpful in my latter years has been meditating. So I meditate every day. Mm. And that has kept me sane in this day and age. I very much enjoy my video channel, which you generously referred to, because I think the ability to share your thoughts with a broader audience is rather a healthy exercise. Otherwise, we become all like, pressure cookers. And we start whistling on our own till we, So I think, and then the writings of the series that I started a long time back of The Undercurrents, which I started when COVID started, and Insanely Sane. So I started this new series called Insanely Sane, and through which I try to think, Richard, and try to transcend and go over some of the things that I feel, why don't we ask a question about them? And these, I would say peripheral efforts have been centered in my practice. But I think as well, Richard, one of the things I find very helpful moving forward and ever more so is connecting with nature. And I don't say this because this is cool at the moment and because we've been confined to our homes. Because when you go for a walk in a park in an early morning and you see the micro order and the beauty and the harmony in nature, and you realize that there is so much for all of us, and we have developed a modern, I would say, dementia, about the generosity of life, earth, and have developed a rather, I would say, a phobia that we may run short on some things. And that is even a smile, which unfortunately these days we are even deprived from smiling at one another behind our masks.
Oh, yes.
And sometimes I say, did we smile enough at one another before COVID arrived? And I doubt we did it. And the other thing is humor. And I think it was a quote I read that the smile is the only curved line that sets everything else straight. So I try to smile a lot, Richard. I try to smile a lot.
Yeah, well, amen to that. I heartily agree. I mean, everything you've been saying, but that's that sense, especially of being in nature. I think there's something about when you're in nature, you feel small, which is a good thing. Because as you were talking to, this sort of sense that we can try and dominate and control nature, we can't, we shouldn't, because we are nature. We are absolutely part of it. And there, in that, there's some kind of sense of a global harmony, of course, and this sense of, as you talked to, the healing that could come from increased understanding and respect that between nations, across political divisions, that would be a fabulous thing to have. So Ali Barani, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your wisdom, your expertise, and joining us on the Mojo podcast today.
Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you for having me.